I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV and Miami University. I'm welcoming Joe Garden of The Onion. You are the features editor
Yes.
of The Onion, and you have been with The Onion for its entire run?
Not quite. The Onion started in 1988, and that was actually when I was an incoming freshman, and so I just picked it up as a fan
at,
for about 5 years.
Wisconsin.
University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Yeah.
And I picked it up as a fan, and then five years later, I was invited to be on the staff, mainly because I was writing signs for – I was writing what I thought, at least, were funny signs for the liquor store I worked at. And some people eventually thought they were funny enough to hire me.
Yeah. What – can you give us an example?
yeah, I guess –
Actually, 1 second. Can you ask them to turn their line on mute unless
Okay, unless you guys are asking a question, could you mute your microphones? And you can probably just leave the microphones in two central locations and mute. Okay, thanks. Okay.
Okay, and then ask if you could pick up the question again.
Yeah, so what were some of, you know, what was an example of a funny sign that you wrote?
The one I keep on coming back to, some of them were, they were very short and pithy, such as the one that had the drawing of a very primitive drawing of a brain. Well, it was painting. It was painted on an existing beer sign, and it was with arrows that said frontal lobe, then backal lobe, and then mickle lobe, thus your product placement, and then squiggly bits, with squiggly bits which defy modern science. And that was one of them. Then I did others that were more essay-oriented, where the product was way at the bottom after you'd have to go through a – if you had the patience, you'd go through a paragraph or two of text before you'd get to the product.
My favorite beer ad, which was for Schaefer Beer, which their actual slogan was the beer of Shea Stadium of the Mets for years, was the one beer to have when you're having more than one, which is like pretty good. Who would like to ask the first question of Joe Gard?
Yes, you.
Yeah. Okay.
Me.
Hello.
Take this one. Is it on?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. My question was, how did you develop your fictional characters, and were they based on, you know, people you know, or parts of your own personality, or how do you tap into those characters when you write?
And could you, I mean, just quickly say who the characters are?
You're referring to Jim Anchauer and Jackie Harvey, I think. Jim Anchauer is sort of like a stoner Hesher character that is always, he's always between jobs. He's always smoking a lot of pot and drinking a lot of beer, and is always somehow getting, basically he's just sort of living a very, he's living a life unexamined, but he's happy to do so. And then Jackie Harvey is he writes a column called The Outside Scoop, which is a gossip column written by the perspective of somebody who doesn't live anywhere near the entertainment industry, doesn't have any actual input from the entertainment industry. So the way those came up and the way I do those, Jim Anchauer was actually the first thing I ever wrote for The Onion. It wound up being, it started off as a thing, the idea was everything I needed to know I learned from The Night of the Living Dead, which then became everything I needed to know I learned from Styx's Paradise Theater, and then it became an essay about by Jim Anchauer about how Paradise Theater was the greatest album. Paradise Theater was a concept album by the band Styx. Maybe you're familiar with Mr. Roboto. Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto. I'm sorry, it's an old song, and it's not really worth going back to find. But, so that was like, I mean, so the way I mean, that's... Eventually, what he wound up being is sort of like a combination of all these people I grew up with. You know, it's sort of like the alternate universe Joe Garden. If I had actually known more about cars and didn't stop smoking pot at some point.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a rural in a town 7 miles outside. No, excuse me. I grew up 7 miles outside of a town of 5,000 people, halfway between Madison, Wisconsin, and La Crosse, Wisconsin. So it was literally, you know, 70 miles away from nowhere, pretty much. And it was, although it is the birthplace of Frank Lloyd Wright and the cartoonist Linda Barry. So those are two things, those are two hooks we hang our hat on. So all these people were people
that
I knew.
What's the name of the town?
Richland Center.
Okay.
Richland Center, Wisconsin. Population 4,997. Standing tall in the Midwest.
How does most of the Onion writers or staffers, are they from small towns?
It used to be the case. Yeah. As time's gone on, we have a, you know, we were originally all, because it was Madison-based, we were all from Wisconsin pretty much, with a handful of exceptions. Now it's about half and half. You know, I'm from Richland Center. John Krusen, who's our sports editor, is from Verona, Wisconsin. Chris Karwowski, who does Onion Radio News, is from Mundelein, Illinois, which is a really a very unnoteworthy suburb of Chicago. Couple people from Michigan, one from Michigan.
Is there a certifiably Midwestern flavor to the Onion? Or does that factor in at all?
I think in a way there is. I mean, I think what it is that we all sort of grew up, on the outside. Like, none of us had any idea how, I mean, when I was growing up writing, I always thought that I would be, first and foremost, I would be a musician. Even though I had no musical talent, I had no patience to learn. I had a bass guitar for a while, and I learned how to play like three Pixies songs, and then I sold it. For me, it was always, I didn't grow up around anybody who was a writer. I didn't really grow up around anybody who was like a noteworthy artist, or anybody who was an artist didn't really stay in Richland Center for very long. Mm-hmm. There was part of a hippie movement to this small area in Wisconsin that, you know, the diaspora, you know, they just as quickly evaporated about 10 years later. So for me, like, the arts were always done by somebody else. I never thought I would actually get a career as a writer. So I came at it from an outsider's perspective, I think. I never thought that what I did would really get very much recognition. And as time went on, I was very, very happy that it started getting recognized outside of Madison.
Next question.
Can you hear me?
Hi.
Yes.
My question is about the writing process at the Onion. How do you guys go about writing stories? Is it like a group of people that work together, or do you just pick your own topic, or what's that dynamic?
Well, it's like this. This is really probably the most boring explanation of any comedy you'll ever hear. So I apologize in advance. But it all starts out. I mean, the process basically goes: on Monday, every writer for the Onion has to come in with 15 ideas, 15 headline ideas. They have to be formed as headlines. If you have to sort of explain them, then they're really not. The joke isn't conveyed very well. So it has to be. Everything has to be really punchy, in that respect. So then we amass a list of somewhere between 90 and like 100, 150 headlines. The next day, we've actually approved, and those are the ones we call having made the list. The next day we come in and we pick the ideas that we think would be good stories, good news and briefs, good just one-liners and skyboxes, and we pick the issue that way. And it's usually sort of a difficult process because a lot of times everybody has a different idea of what's going to make a good story and what isn't. Sometimes it goes smoothly. A lot of times it's just a very long, contentious meeting. Everybody then is assigned a story. A lot of times it'll be from your own idea, but not always. You may actually have an affinity for an idea that wasn't yours in the first place, but you write it, and on Wednesday you write it, everybody writes their stories. On Thursday you come in and read your drafts, and everybody sort of picks it apart. Then you go back and rewrite it for Friday, and then you go through the edit, then it goes through the editors, who go over it again, and then if you have any problems with what they've done, I mean, it's collaborative, but there is like a unique author voice to it, would be the best way to put it. The author usually does have, they don't have final say, but at least they have a lot more say than in a lot of publications.
What's the single story are you most proud of doing?
I'd say the single story I'm proudest of is Well, there's a few, actually. One is the comic book nerd in me loves Why No One Want Make Hulk 2 by Hulk. And it's a very, like, if you're familiar with the first Hulk movie that came out, not the new one, I know Nick hates it, but I actually kind of like the Hulk movie. And so it's in the voice of the Hulk, where he's like, Why No One Want Make Hulk 2? Ang Lee, underappreciated genius. And that was a fun article to write, writing in the Hulk voice when you're trying to put together complex thoughts in a voice of somebody who just can't use a conjunction is amazing. It's very fun. Then this story actually doesn't even make any sense anymore because it's called Fuck Everything. We're doing Five Blades,
right.
And it's by the CEO of Gillette, and this is before the Five Blade Razor Fusion actually came out. And it just started out. That was one where the editorial process worked well because in the first meeting, it wasn't getting a lot of traction. Nobody was really that happy with it. But I was like, this could be really funny. So I did my first two drafts of it, and then I got it about like 70% of the way there to where it was. And then the editors just like, they basically just honed it razor sharp, and it was just it was amazing when it was done.
That was one of the pieces that we read, and everybody enjoyed it quite a bit.
Yeah.
What was the genesis? Guys, pipe in if you disagree, but we read a bunch of things from the 1789 issue. Mm-hmm. Nobody really liked that.
Really?
What was the and actually,
well,
could somebody talk about why you didn't find that as humorous?
I'm memorizing your faces right now.
Yeah. Would somebody like to, kind of work through? Okay, thank you, Cassie, for taking the bullet here. Megan, excuse me.
It was the first one I read, and I had just been familiar with The Onion in terms of the videos before, which are much more kind of modern and
contemporary,
I guess. So when I read it, I was like, well, this is kind of history, and it's poking fun at history, but I wasn't expecting it. And I guess when I was reading it, like, the weird capitalization's funny and the spelling's funny, but besides that, I was like, the actual historical humor was kind of lost on me. I mean, I knew what you were poking fun at, but I just was more entertained by stuff I could more easily relate to, I guess.
Sure. That makes sense. I mean, I totally understand that. I think for us we were just trying to do something. We try to do some like different things periodically.
Like theme issues.
We did one from the future at one point.
Which is hilarious.
The future one is also great. The genetically engineered farmers are really funny.
We need a fourth law of robotics.
Stop fingering my wife. That was my
story.
That's,
that's very funny. So did the 1789 issue do well? Or how do you gauge viewership and things like that? Or how important is the feedback loop of the readership?
It's really not that important. Mm-hmm. We try to, because if we pay too much attention to what, granted, you have to pay attention to what the readership wants, but if you pay too much attention, you'll just start to try to please the reader all the time. And first and foremost, we've got to please ourselves as comedy fans. With the 1783 issue, I think we were
1783.
That's fine. We were happy with it, I understand what you're saying. It was one of those things where it's hard for us to switch the voice. We're used to doing, it's hard to actually figure out what the comedy tone is going to be. And, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. We got a letter from a George Washington Historical Foundation that they loved it. So maybe that was our niche audience right there, was history buffs and Civil War reenactors. Well, not even Civil Revolutionary War reenactors.
Next question. Okay, Nick, go ahead.
Same lines of like pleasing your viewers, is there a target segment that you
actually go towards for like your articles? Is there like a segment that you're trying to target the Onion towards, kind of more in a business topic than author?
Well, not really. I think it's like what we have to do is we have to make ourselves. We don't ever, when we're pitching ideas, we don't ever say, this is something that will be very good with our readers, so this is something we have to do. In that respect, we've actually, you know, sometimes, in fact, it'll be exactly the opposite. For example, Sarah Palin jokes are very easy to make, and we've made a few, but now because it's become such a, you know, Saturday Night Live kind of owns Sarah Palin, we've sort of backed off on that, and we've decided, you know, unless we come up with the best Sarah Palin joke in the world, we're probably not going to, you know, we're probably not going to make it. Even though that, you know, a lot of times, I will say this. There was a time when in the course of being the features editor, one of the things I oversee is the American Voices, which is sort of like a man on the street interview segment where they give you a topic and it's like, what do you think? That's what it always ends with. And I decided, I was going to say, well, let's see if I can drive this to number one. And it was about an Iowa, a professor at the University of Iowa who was, you know, basically exchanging A's for, you know, not even, well, they were sexual favors, basically. But it wasn't like, it wasn't Clintonian sexual favors. It was more like, he was like first letting him feel your boobs. And so I called it the Iowa, the heading was Iowa Boobs for Grades Scandal. And I did that explicitly to see if I could make that go to number one. But by and large, we don't really chase the reader a lot. We just try to make ourselves, you know, we try to say something new or something interesting or something that we haven't said already before, which after 20 years is really fucking hard.
Who are your influences in terms of either humor or writing in general, and then what's kind of the menu of media that you consume?
For me, the main influence I had would probably be, you know, starting off with Mad Magazine, specifically Don Martin, because I loved his absurdist. Like Don Martin, you should go look up his stuff. He had just the greatest drawing style. His famous trademark was the hinge foot guy, and always the best sound effects, like splorf or fnaffle or things like that. So Mad Magazine, for their anti-authoritarian bent. The Little Rascals would at a very young age, because they also had the same. That was like the first snobs versus slobs comedy I absorbed.
Are you guys familiar with the Little Rascals?
Yeah. AKA Our Gang.
Yeah. Spanky, Alfalfa.
It's funny because when I was growing up, they were showing edited versions on TV, and even looking back at those, I think those edited versions were pretty. They're still fairly racist.
Did you ever, there's a great late episode when Robert Blake was on there where a Chinese family moves into the neighborhood and are mistaken as Japanese.
Oh,
really? It is tremendous. And then it ends with Froggy, isn't it, eating Chinese food and being like, it looks horrible, but it tastes great. it's very strange. But so
Robert Blake, a.k.a., he was on as Mickey Blake or Mickey Gubitosi, depending upon the... Or Bobby Blake.
Yeah.
And he killed his ex-wife. Probably. But yeah, and then what else? Steve Martin was a big influence. Then Monty Python and sort of like I think Monty Python really helped a lot because that was comedy that was like really absurdist, but it was played so straight that, I mean, that was one of their strengths is that they were able to take these premises and just, you know, the Confuse a Cat sketch, for example, where they have a woman is concerned because her cat isn't moving, and so they call Confuse a Cat, which is a service that comes in and makes sure your cat. They do all these strange things to confuse your cat. It sounds really stupid, but it's a really funny sketch because they just treat it so dryly. A lot of things like that. There's some of the Mel Brooks movies. I guess that would, and then like, you know, as I got older, reading Kurt Vonnegut and reading Kurt Vonnegut and reading Catch-22 were also influential. I read Candide every year for about 5 years. I guess, and then you wanted to know about the palette of media.
The brilliance of The Onion and the sustained effect of it is, I mean, that it perfectly mirrors actual media. I mean, what are the things that you read, you know, on a daily basis or view or whatever?
Well, we don't have cable anymore, so that was the thing. Mm-hmm. We for a while I was watching Bill O'Reilly every night because I was like, you know, and actually. One of the best things you could do is watch the Today Show, because the Today Show is the perfect mirror of of what middle America is knows about and is interested in. That's how I found out about The Secret, and I actually got so angry I really almost.
Are you guys familiar with the book and gimmick of The Secret?
Basically, it's a bunch of new age repackaged new age bullshit that says. It's sort of like the cosmos is like a giant slot machine that's fed on wishes. And if you put enough wishes in the cosmos, it'll fall down on you. You'll hit a jackpot in the form of money. And they treat it like it's science, which is the worst thing of all. They say it's like, that's what made me so angry watching it and seeing this person. And he was getting the last word. He's like, well, it's just science. All matter is energy, and you're made of matter. So if you, you know, think something hard enough, it's converted into energy. And I'm just like, no! And it's just... And the woman who was his counterpoint was just spitting. She just wanted to say something so bad. And it was so we actually tried to do some Onion colleagues and I tried to do a secret parody. Mm. But what we wrote was really funny, and I stand by it as hilarious. But they're like, nobody's really interested. So eventually we'll put it online. Just as a side project, not as an Onion project.
Next question. Yeah, Chelsea?
If you could be the half-sibling, like Cooter was to Obama, to any celebrity or political figure, so that you could piggyback on all of their fame and wealth, who would it be and why?
Oh, boy. I'd say maybe there's a possibility of Brad Pitt, because Brad Pitt... he gets to go to all the exotic locations, and I'd I have such admiration for the star of Meet Joe Black. It's just such a fantastic film. Who else? I guess the great thing about that is that was actually, you might have heard of Roger Clinton, the hillbilly half brother or the hillbilly brother of Bill Clinton.
Right.
But the real precedent for that is Billy Carter, who once who was President Jimmy Carter's half or real he was his full brother
full
actually,
brother,
and they made a beer for him, Billy Beer, and actually one of his more famous things is like in full view of a bunch of dignitaries he actually stepped off an airplane and urinated on the tarmac in front of everybody. And so, you know, you just read this and you're just like, you know, that's where the hillbilly half-brother came from. But it was such a great, you know, that was really fun to write because, Barack Obama is so, like, so erudite and so eloquent. And to have him, like, to give him a hillbilly half-brother was just loads of fun. Who else would I be a hillbilly half-brother to? No, I think it begins and ends with Brad Pitt. I can't think of anybody else. I would
so
actually...
many things do.
Could you handle the six nieces and nephews that would come with that?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. I'd just give them some firecrackers and let them go nuts. Why? That's how I.
next question.
How much of it is just you deciding to go with thoughts, and how much of it is doing research or interviewing someone and changing it completely? Or what do you guys do in terms of when you write it, the process of, is it actually facts that you twist, or is it just, oh, I heard about this and make it into whatever you want?
We never do our own interviews. We base everything on, everything is fictional, but sometimes in doing fiction you can actually... get it, you can get it at the greater truth. And that's, you know, that's kind of the liberating thing about writing satire and writing fake news, is that you can actually intimate things that people don't, don't say. You know, that like you can say the unspoken things with it. But we try to research everything as much as possible. We don't like, you know, if you make something that's based entirely on, if you build your jokes on straw men, like if you take a subject that you think it's the way people perceive things, and then you make your joke around that, that's really bad satire because you're not really commenting on a real thing and you're not doing anything that people will identify with. What you're doing is you're just sort of trying to twist reality to suit your joke. And so you should, like, everything has to, like, usually everything should be fairly well grounded in reality.
Is there one of the things that we're talking about in this class over the course of the semester is, and the title is Politics, Culture, and New Media, but is there a politics to the Onion or an ideology, or kind of in terms of satire, there is normally a, you know, something like Candide is satirizing utilitarian philosophy kind of optimism, things like that, or the ideas of scientific progress, et cetera. Is there a larger point to the Onion?
I think one of the things, our motto in Latin is tu stultus est, which is you are dumb. And I think that's kind of the only thing that's our only guiding principle, is we just sort of try to attack dumb things, and we try to write about things that we think are dumb, or if things aren't, you know. And so that, I think, would be our but we don't really have, besides that, a pervasive, I was going to say theology, but really a political ideology. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's the same thing. We don't, like, I mean, we all have our individual political beliefs, but for the good of the paper, we try to be even-handed. Obviously, though, the funniest jokes, the best jokes come out of, you know, the power, you know, come at the expense of the people in power, because it's not really, it's usually not funny or good, you know, good comedy or intelligent to attack people that are not, you know, that are not in power.
Right.
Because it's just like, then it's sort of like just shooting fish in a barrel, which has its place, but and every once in a while it can be funny, but usually the best thing to do is to, keep your aim high, I suppose.
What do you think, does the Onion function as a kind of creator of media literacy, do you think? I mean, I realize you don't write to the audience, but your readership skews, it's got to be virtually everybody, all of it's under 40 or whatever. But, I mean, and it's part of a larger kind of movement of a lot of kind of self-critical media formats. I mean, South Park does this in its own way, you know, The Simpsons does, various other things, The Onion. I mean, is it creating more media-savvy consumers of media, do you think?
I don't know. I think a lot of, you know, I don't ever want to underestimate the savvy of media consumers at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was growing up, we had, I lived in the country, we had three channels, maybe four on a good night. And so I made do with the media I had, and so I didn't, you know. So you notice sort of weird things about, you know, you just sort of absorb things equally. Like, you don't, there's no, because you don't really, you have fewer places to choose from, or then you're just like a lot less discriminating, and you sort of like absorb a lot of things equally. Thus, you know, Hogan's Heroes was a big part of my growing up, even though it's a really bad comedy about...
it's pretty funny.
There are funny bits in it. I actually, I was going to get totally off subject and go into the plot of one where with a chimpanzee that somehow gets smuggled into this this Nazi camp. But anyway, so you just sort of but today I don't know. I can't answer that really because I don't know how people absorb media today because you have so many more choices because not only do you have television and radio, you have the internet, and you have and the internet opens you up to thousands of possibilities. Right. So I think that people are a lot more, you know, are becoming a lot more savvy almost without, you know, by, you know,
whether they want to or not.
Right. Yeah, it's by just because of media evolution. I don't know if people... It might be breeding cynicism. And that's always a concern of mine, that The Onion and fake news in general just sort of breeds a cynical point of view, and it doesn't really... It doesn't answer or address anything. It just sort of... it makes people just sort of tune out the regular news and makes them very... and so that's a, you know, that's always a concern of mine.
That's an interesting insight, actually, based on various things that we were talking about. Of, you know, is a response to something like The Onion, is it cynicism or is it media? You know, is it a more perceptive understanding of how media functions? That's something that we really hadn't, or I hadn't considered. But next question.
I guess, why do you think people are so drawn to satire over your traditional news? And what would you say to people that this, like, The Onion is their only, like, intake of any form of news?
I don't, well, I'd hoped people had other, because we're not very accurate. I think, why are people drawn to it? I think people are drawn to it partially because it's, it's very, you know, the news is just very, can be overwhelming, and reading satirical news or watching The Daily Show gives you sort of another way to process it. It's another way to process the information that's coming at you, and especially at a time like now when we're at war with two countries, in two countries, and our economy is just failing. Everybody wants to have a different, it's good to have a different viewpoint to help sort of like, you know, it may not answer your question specifically, but at least it can give you another processing mechanism to sort of to cope with it. And again, I'd hope that people get their news from other places besides The Onion and The Daily Show. It doesn't make my job easier if people don't know the news besides what we give them. Excuse me. I think also... I think it would be, you know, I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question or not. I'm trying to think if there's any further addendum to it that I have, but I think that's kind of it. Yeah.
Next question.
Okay, so I'm currently looking at your Election 08 site, and it's extremely hilarious, but...
Mary, could you, what's the main headline?
Oh, the election, how it works. Well, I'm under, like, the process.
Okay.
But it's just funny because, like, it's a lot of, like, comparing, like, the first thing I see is Republican convention official partners, and they have, like, Vlasic pickles and chilies. but after the election, like, where will you go with this? Like, what if there's, like, nothing else to make fun of?
I think.
I mean, that's a huge what if, but.
I don't think that's ever the. I don't think that's ever going to be the case. I mean, after the election, no matter who wins, things aren't going to get better for a very long time. And even if they do get better, there'll still be other things to make fun of. And there'll always be, you know, even when we were under a lot of prosperity, you know, even when we were under relative prosperity, which is an interesting side note. And this may belie ignorance on my part, but I always find it amazing that people ascribe our period of prosperity, like that it's that they ascribe Bill Clinton with having had to do something with that. The fact is that he was in, he just happened to be the president while we had the biggest technological revolution since Henry Ford, noted anti-Semite Henry Ford, I should say. And so it's an interesting thing. It's like that's an aside. I shouldn't even. When he was a president and things seemed to be going peachy keen, when we were only bombing
Sudan and Afghanistan,
right? Yep. Only from afar. We weren't actually sending troops there. Yeah. What we were able to do is like what we did is we made fun of the fact that Bill Clinton was, as a president, he wanted to be liked. That was his main. That was seemed to be his main. Not just by by the public, like he'd do anything, and to be sort of like the most liked president or most liked man in America. So we did things like because of his desire to please people, we did stories like Clinton seduced by international suave international jewel thief, Clinton tagged, where just Clinton standing there. He had like all these guys had come up and like graffitied him.
What are the analogs for McCain and Obama? Or have you worked those out?
We're still trying to work it out. I mean, McCain, it's hard because like one of the things that everybody, one of the things we tried to avoid with Bush is the Bush is dumb jokes, because that was the obvious take that everybody was doing from the get-go. And so we started out doing like an exact, very sarcastic reversal of that. Like Bush... It was, I think the first story was Bush amazes dinner guests with impromptu oratory about Virgil's minor works. Mm. And then it was like Bush finds error in Fermi's superconductor calculations. And it was always like him doing these really esoteric smart things. And then 9/11 happened, and then everybody stopped making him dumb, and so we stopped making him smart.
How did you talk a little bit about how you guys dealt with 9/11?
The 9/11 issue, if you can look it up, it's Holy Fucking Shit, America Under Attack. That was the name of our special coverage of that. What we were actually set to run a regular issue that week, and we delayed. None of us could get to, we weren't really supposed to go into Manhattan, so we had just actually moved to New York that year, earlier that year, and... so we were just we were just like, as new Yorkers, like, how do we deal with this? Right. And we put the issue together that was, it was kind of terrifying to me because I had just spent, what to me at the time was a fortune moving to New York. And I was going to, this was going to be my new life, was being, like, living in New York and writing comedy. And I thought that after reading this, we were going to be run out of town. Like, people were going to chase after us with torches. It was going to be an angry mob. But we did it, what we ended up doing is we just sort of, the tack we took was we talked about the stories that we almost talked about the stories that nobody else was talking about. We talked about this, just the sort of like the new feelings of vulnerability and confusion. My favorite headline from that, and probably one of my favorite Onion headlines ever, was not knowing what else to do, woman bakes American flag cake. And it's like at the end with her going, it's a really beautiful cake. And then they start crying. And it was just like, it was funny and it was touching because it really did address something that people were, that people were feeling. They sort of felt this new confusion about what their position in life was. And I think a lot of it was like that. The piece I worked on, which was edited... I could have done a much better job. Now that I'm a better writer, I sort of look back on it, and it was like, how to tell your children about the attacks of September 11th. And instead of being like, okay, we'll sit them down, it was more like, well, it all started basically. You can trace the roots of Islamic fundamentalism back to Sayyid Qutb in 1942 when he went on his trip to the United States, and a lot of people, he was concerned about the apostasis, the people who had turned their back on this. And so it was like this very long and complex thing that went through like the funding of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And so that was, I wish I could go back and rewrite it because I could have done a much better job now.
Well, maybe there'll be another terrorist attack.
Oh, jeez, here's hoping.
Next question.
Sure, that doesn't ever happen to you.
Oh, it happens.
Maybe your least funny story, and what did you learn from that?
Oh boy, I wrote a lot of stories where I was getting my legs, and that just I can't even. I mean, to be honest, I can't recall any off the top of my head. We've done some that I think some of them we've done have been. We've done some that are like where the message is more important than the joke, and it's a little heavy-handed. Bush leads troops into war, I think, was one that I wasn't particularly fond of. because it was just the sarcasm was sort of leaden and obvious to me. But I mean, we did have to have a response to that. I don't think the only things we get negative responses about, like a really negative response to, are the most banal. Well, we did get one interesting one where it was after Timothy McVeigh, the bomber of the federal building in Oklahoma City, after he was executed, we ran a news and brief, Everything Better Now in Oklahoma City. And it just said that the doves came out, and it was just, and that was really sarcastic. And it was, for us, it was, the point was, we're not rabidly anti-death penalty, but we're just like this, everybody was out for blood and you got it, and what really happened in the end. And we had one guy write and said, I used to be a newsman there, and I will do everything I can to see the onion buried unless you retract that story. That was 7 years ago.
Did you run that letter?
We haven't run letters.
Right?
I would.
Yeah.
It would be tempting to actually go back and run some of our old complaint letters.
Yeah.
The story we ran that got the most complaints, it was a slight and insignificant story. It was an editorial by this woman, Kathy Kelleher, actually Maria Schneider, who is no longer at the paper. But the story was Mary Kate is dragging Ashley down. And it was sort of a fun, it was just sort of a mean, like, sort of dig on Mary Kate and Ashley Olsen about how one was totally talentless and the other one was so much more talented. And it was like, it was kind of funny, but it was like really nothing we thought about. We got so much hate mail from people who were fans of Mary Kate and Ashley Olsen, and it wasn't just 12-year-old girls, it was their mothers. It was single
uncles, I'm sure.
Single 40-year-old men that were writing into us. One of them said, "You say that Mary Kate is fat? Well, guess what? Look in the mirror, because you're fat." But I mean, as far as like, I think the things, getting back to the original point, I think a lot of the things, for me personally, the problems I've had with stories that I've written are I didn't take the joke far enough. I didn't really dig into the humor as well as I could have. Or in general at the Onion, we tried to make a point that was like where the point superseded anything funny.
Yeah. Another question.
This is interesting. I like watching the microphone get passed around. I feel like it's like a sort of Oprah in that respect.
Yeah. I don't know how to respond to that.
That's okay. Because under your seat right now, there's a new car. The faux car, not the keys. There's an actual car.
Sorry. Okay, anyway, I guess you can hear me.
Okay.
Yes.
My question is a little different, not so much about the coverage, but it's more, what is the makeup of the Onion newsroom? Like, how big is the staff? How many editors are there? Is there a big web team versus printer? How does that work out?
It's divided into two. The creative side is divided into two sections. We have the web video section, and they are responsible for writing all their material. They have four writers and about eight contributors that work on it. And then there's the paper section, which has about... It's hard to break it down because a lot of the people that are editors are also writers. Like, I'm the features editor, but I'm also writing a story a week. So I'll say we have people writing, like 8 to 9 people writing every week. And we have, three people that will, edit those stories, but there's an overlap in the people that are writing and editing.
What's the age range?
The age range is from, 24 to 40 right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting because for a long time, there was a lot of. It was a very static. It was a very static group at the Onion. Like, nobody was really leaving, and suddenly we lost a few people here and there, and we needed to replace them. And so the people we hired, there was like a, so we had people in there like all within a five-year age grouping, and then the next youngest writer was 10 years younger than that, and so then there's like a younger grouping. So it's almost like there's not, we're certainly not like, the youngs versus the olds, although there is...
It's getting there.
What else? Baratunde Thurston is our web editor. He's our War for the White House editor. He's also, I think he's our first. I think he's our first official. Well, Boston University isn't Ivy League, is it?
No.
No. Okay. So he's our first official Ivy League writer or slash editor.
Not if he's from Boston University. Oh,
no, he's from Harvard, actually.
Okay, I see, I see. Now, is that going to drive it down? I mean, once you leave the Big Ten? I mean.
We have, we used to have a series of rules that you had to have cleaned a grease trap, you had to have been punched in the face. And there was one other thing you had to do before you could be an Onion writer.
What was the other thing?
I can't remember what the last
Here,
thing was.
Talk a little bit about, because part of what we do in these discussions is we talk about the work itself and then about the kind of larger media context, but also career-wise. So, I mean, your only job has been with the Onion.
Well, that's not true. I was a temporary secretary, full-time secretary. Mm-hmm. I've worked in many universities where I've messed up a lot of people's reimbursement forms.
Okay.
I was a terrible secretary, and thank God for satire.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'd be starving and still messing up people's reimbursement forms.
Mm-hmm.
I also worked at a few odd jobs here. Mm-hmm. I worked at a punk rock record distribution place for a while. It was a very ungratifying job.
How important, I mean, many of the people in this class are going on to careers in journalism or media or marketing. How important is it to have that kind of background where you bump around a while?
I think it's really important. I think it's the best advice I could give to anybody who's looking to get into like a media or a creative career is to just go out and like find a job that find a job that fills the time. Like a lot of people will, I mean, the thing is, I always feel weird about internship opportunities because I always am suspicious of people that can afford internship opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's good to be able to do that if you can balance that with like a job, say washing dishes at a restaurant, or one of my favorite, Joe Matt, who's a cartoonist. He wrote Palestine and a few other comics. One of his first jobs was at a he was working for a paper. It was a trade magazine for Notaries Public. So he had to learn about being a notary public, and he had to do that. That was his job.
Yeah.
He had to like write about that things every week, and he said things like that. Especially with writing, if you take a really bad writing job, you really learn something about yourself, and you learn something about what you're what you're able to do.
Yeah. I once worked for a trade magazine called So Business, SEW, which was like about yarn and thread and whatnot. So let's have one or two more questions from the class, please.
Okay, back to your career stuff. What's your favorite thing about being a writer?
Just the high self-esteem that comes with writing and knowing that everything I do is just sheer genius. It's an amazing, amazing feeling when I turn in my copy and I think, my God, I've just changed people's lives. Now, I think it's... I like it because it gives me an opportunity to express... I have an opportunity to express myself in, in a creative fashion where I get paid. And if there's things that I... And the great thing about the current media landscape is that there's things I want to write about that I won't pay, that I can't guarantee that people will be interested in. I can just write a blog, and it'll be I can guarantee.
Do you have a blog?
I currently have two blogs, they've both fallen behind. It's very important. I actually get on one. One of them is called Needle Dropper, in which I go through all the old records I've purchased at thrift stores in the last like 10 years, and I'm like that I've never listened to, and I'm like. Holy shit, I have too many records.
Right.
It's time to actually sit down and figure out what to do with this record.
Right.
So I read about that, and then it also comes... It's sort of like a general music blog, like the best and worst songs, rock songs about rock is a topic I cover. And, the 7-second concert review, which is like, you don't have, you're a busy guy. You don't have time to go see a concert. You don't have time to go to this. Hell, you don't even have time to read about it. So here's what happened to this concert in 7 seconds.
Are you generally bullish on the media landscape? Because some of the stuff that we've talked about earlier, there's a lot of pessimism about news media, mm-hmm. things like that. How do you feel about it?
I think I'm curious to see what's going to happen, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm bullish on the mass media landscape. I don't know if we're going to maintain a... I don't know if big media is going to be able to maintain. I think what's going to happen... I think, you know, television particularly, if you can get people... I mean, if you can, like, buy what is essentially a television studio for $5,000, which is, you know, not chump change...
Yeah, but it's cheap.
But it's within reason. You know, you can... You know, what's? I think more and more people are going to start making their own entertainment, and I think more and more people are going to start making their own quality entertainment because the means of editing and the means of so I think that as that happens, there'll be a market. There'll be a way that people can start getting money for that.
Right.
You know, I think that you know sites like YouTube are going to start. I think eventually what they'll have to do is start to offer some sort of cut in the ad revenue, just like Facebook. If you click on Facebook, an application, the people who create the application get a share of that.
Right.
So I think I'm bullish in that respect.
Does it, you know, you talked, and I'm not sure about your experiences growing up, and it's a very different media world, just where everybody has cable versus before that. But, you know, you talked a bit about growing up in a small town with very limited media options or cultural options. Mm. Is there a power in really being forced to, you know, consume Hogan's Heroes itself is an ironic show, but then you're working it over and actually growing up relatively deprived?
I think there is, honestly, I do think that there's something to that because I think if you have limited options, you do have to consume, you know, you do have to consume what's available and you have to, and as a result, you'll be exposed to things that you might not gravitate toward ordinarily. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know how people feel about the, you know, I don't know how, if people, you know, it's one of those things where it's constantly a battle because I don't want to be like, you kids today and you're 14,000 channels in your internet. But, I'm really worried about that. I don't want to come off as being the curmudgeonly old guy that thinks that kids have it too easy. There is that part of me that also, I'm curious, like how it differentiates, you know, what's the common ground if you have, if you have so many options, I guess the common ground is shared links and, you know, the Ninja Cat, which is, by the way, the best YouTube clip ever. I don't know if you, how many people have seen Ninja Cat? Okay. Only one? Yeah. That's really shocking. It's a great, look it up. It's a wonderful. It's a wonderful bit of cat humor and cat-based
and
humor.
Joe has a book about cats coming out soon, which we'll talk about later. We're going to wrap it up because we're actually out of time here on our camera.
Okay,
guys, take five, and we'll come back, and I'll do a little bit of business in about 5 minutes. Okay, thanks very much for your questions. Okay,
thanks.
Thanks, and thank you, Joe. Oh.